Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and maybe you know the saying that if you're not a liberal when you're 20, you have no heart, but if you're not a conservative when you're 40, you have no brain. Well, my next guest flips that script. Max Boot first came to prominence as a historian and military analyst just after 9/11 with an article in the conservative Weekly Standard called The Case for American Empire. I remember thinking it was a weird moment to call for such a thing, just as our empire-building chickens were coming home to roost, people argued. At the time, he was a young movement conservative on the rise. Max's first appearance on this program was in a debate in 2004 on the question, has the Iraq War made us safer? He was arguing pro-Iraq War. He went on to become a Council on Foreign Relations Fellow and senior foreign policy advisor to the presidential campaigns of three Republican candidates, McCain, Romney, and Rubio. He was a columnist for the Wall Street Journal. But now in his late 40s, Max Boot's new book is called The Corrosion of Conservatism, Why I Left the Right. We'll hear about his journey in just a minute, which, by the way, starts as a baby in the old Soviet Union. But relevant to the news of today, and obviously well before the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, Max wrote for this book that Donald Trump gets along disturbingly well with dictators. And Max uses as his first example the Saudis projecting a five-story size image of Trump onto the side of Trump's hotel in Riyadh last year. As some of you know, Trump famously said this as a candidate.
Saudi Arabia, and I get along great with all of them. They buy apartments from me, they spend $40 million, $50 million. Am I supposed to dislike them? I like them very much.
In that same section of Max Boot's new book, he notes that just as Trump started trade negotiations with China and was parading his, quote, incredibly warm relations with Xi Jinping, a Chinese state-owned bank provided a $500 million in loans for a project in Indonesia that includes a Trump-branded series of residences, hotels, and a golf course. Emoluments for breakfast, anyone? Max Boot, now a Washington Post columnist and still a senior fellow for national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, joins us. Again, his new book is called The Corrosion of Conservatism, Why I Left the Right. This is his 10th appearance on The Brian Lehrer Show. And I guess, Max, you're first as an official ex-conservative.
Happy to be here in whatever capacity.
You were born in 1969. In the Soviet Union. Your father was a Jewish refusenik. Can you tell us a little of his story?
Well, he was one of these young, urban Jewish dissidents in the Soviet Union who was very dissatisfied with life and finally was able to escape in large part because of U.S. pressure on human rights on the Soviet Union. And he got out of the Soviet Union. Then a couple of years later, in 1976, I came out 6 years old with my mother and grandmother, and we came to L.A. in Southern California, where I wound up growing up.
A lot of Soviet and other East European emigres who might have been seen as progressives in the Soviet context because they wanted freedom of speech and religion and some democracy wind up conservative in this country because their experience leaves them skeptical of big government and socialist-leaning economics as leading to tyranny. While, you know, American liberals see the government as a bulwark against corporate tyranny, how much were you in that pattern of Soviet emigre worldview?
Very much so. And it's not just Soviet. I mean, it's also Cuban refugees, sure. Vietnamese refugees. I think anybody who escapes a communist country is looking for an anti-communist, more conservative alternative. And certainly I was drawn in the 1980s as a young man to the party of Ronald Reagan, who called the Soviet Union an evil empire and stood up for American values. And so, you know, I could never have imagined at that time that eventually Ronald Reagan would be succeeded as president and as head of the Republican Party by somebody who seems to be in love with the despot in the Kremlin.
And you write that your personal experience gave you the belief that moral concerns should have a prominent place in U.S. foreign policy. Through that lens, how are you seeing Trump's reaction to Jamal Khashoggi, or even more than Jamal Khashoggi?
Well, it's appalling. I mean, Donald Trump is a values-free zone. I mean, if you look at what gets him exercised, he gets very worked up about Canadian milk. He gets very worked up about poor refugees in Latin America who want to come here, but he doesn't really seem to give a damn about the fact that our close allies, the Saudis, apparently tortured, murdered, and dismembered somebody who was an American resident and a writer for an American newspaper. I mean, this to me is a negation of everything that America should stand for.
There's an article in the Federalist today, conservative site, that argues Trump is right to be cautious in how we punish the Saudis on this, because even assuming the worst, we still need them as a major bulwark against Iran in the region, much more evil than the Saudis, arguably, and for energy and Mideast diplomacy, the article says. So we only have morally imperfect choices, only bad choices and worse choices. I'm curious for you as a military and foreign policy historian, how much does that ring true or false?
I think that's an exaggeration. I mean, nobody is suggesting that we have to abandon Saudi Arabia. We're not going to go to war with Saudi Arabia. We're not going to end our alliance with Saudi Arabia. But we have to make clear to the Saudis and to the whole rest of the world that there are certain red lines you cannot cross. There is certain behavior we will not accept. And the culpability here, I think, is really with Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, who has been a very reckless ruler. I mean, he's done a few good things like letting women drive, but he's also done a lot of crazy things like kidnapping the prime minister of Lebanon. And you know, with this murder of Jamal Khashoggi, I think he has really placed himself beyond the pale. I mean, Saudi Arabia got along fine for decades without MBS, as he's known, in charge, and it will get along just fine without MBS in the future. But I think we have to hold him accountable for this monstrous crime.
Through the entire Cold War and our almost century of living on imported oil, many U.S. presidents have swept moral concerns under the rug with Arab dictators, including the Saudis, arguably contributing to 9/11, among other things, and the persistent power of the strong men who the Arab Spring tried to topple with such disastrous humanitarian results in many places. So from a moral foreign policy historian's perspective, how much is Trump different in kind as opposed to simply in style?
I think it's certainly true that past presidents have made compromises with dictators, but I think Trump is different because he has completely abdicated any kind of moral responsibility or moral leadership. He has made crystal clear he doesn't care at all about moral values. With past presidents, you could say that they were inconsistent in their advocacy for human rights. Donald Trump is not inconsistent. He is consistent. He doesn't care about human rights. And that is very different from Ronald Reagan. I mean, as we were discussing, I grew up as a Ronald Reagan conservative in the 1980s. And one of the things that I admired about Reagan was not only that he called out the Soviet Union as an evil empire and stood up for human rights and the suffering behind the Iron Curtain, but he also called out American allies. I mean, people forget this, but in 1986, when there was a people power uprising in the Philippines against Ferdinand Marcos, Ronald Reagan eventually told Marcos that he had to go, that the United States was not going to back him up in repressing this uprising.
Good example.
And that's the exact opposite of the Donald Trump approach.
Max Boot, our guest, his new book, The Corrosion of Conservatism, Why I Left the Right. You write about a conservative bubble, as you call it, and you say that it blinded you earlier on in your life, or at least obscured the strains of racism and sexism in the party. Will you talk about that?
This is something that I should have been much more aware of earlier on, but I was really in denial. I was in this kind of tribalistic right-wing bubble. And so when liberals said the Republican Party is racist, I thought that was a slur because I said, hey, I'm not racist. My friends aren't racist. What are you talking about? And then, of course, with Donald Trump's 2016 election, the dog whistle to racism became a wolf whistle, and even I heard it. I couldn't deny it anymore. Because it was just so blatant. I mean, this is a guy who began his campaign by attacking Mexicans as rapists and murderers, which was just so completely unacceptable to me. And I was shocked to see that Republicans not only accepted it, but a lot of them loved it. I mean, that was actually the core of a lot of his appeal. And what that's done for me is made me go back and rethink the whole history of the Republican Party and realize what a lot of liberals have realized all along. Oh, wait a second. There is a long, sad, pathetic history of Republicans pandering to racists. It did not start with Donald Trump. He has just made it a little bit more or a lot more blatant than it was in the past.
You go back even as far as revisiting a Barry Goldwater speech. Tell us about that.
I've really been revisiting the roots of modern conservatism and realizing that a lot of the people that I admired as a young man, folks like Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan and William F. Buckley Jr. and others, they were complicit in some of what the Republican Party has become. And I think the turning point was 1964, when the Republican Party went from being the party of Lincoln to being the party of Southern whites, essentially defending white segregation. And Barry Goldwater was key to that because he opposed the Great Civil Rights Legislation in 1964-65. And, you know, he won the nomination at the Cow Palace in San Francisco in an atmosphere that a lot of people compared to Hitler rallies. I mean, it was so fervent. And, you know, his supporters were booing Governor Nelson Rockefeller. That was really kind of the proto-Trumpist takeover of the Republican Party, although in later years, I will add, Barry Goldwater, I think, became much more moderate and libertarian.
I mentioned in introducing you that this is your 10th appearance on this show, and the first one was in 2004 in a debate called Has the Iraq War Made Us Safer? The war, of course, was only 1 year old then, and I'm going to play 23 seconds of your first appearance on this show in 2004.
Uh-oh.
But the larger point you raised, Brian, is are we safer? And the answer, the honest answer, is it's too soon to tell. That's like asking in 1942 or 1943, are we safer because of the war on the Axis powers? Well, it's hard to know, because if you lose, then you're not safer. But if you win, you are much safer. And I think if we win in Iraq, we will be much safer. And if we lose, we will be much less safe. So those are the stakes at play.
So even in 2004, when you were here to argue one side in a debate, you were still being thoughtful Max Boot and saying it's too early to know and not firmly taking a side.
Thank you. But I was actually cringing when you were getting ready to play that. I was thinking, oh, my God, what did I say? And that clip wasn't bad, so thank you.
But how do you answer your own question now 15 years later? Because you were saying, well, it's too early to tell if the Iraq War made us safer.
I don't think it did make us safer. And one of the things I do in this book is for the first time recant my support for the Iraq War. I mean, I was somebody who was in denial for a long time and kind of stubbornly refused to admit what was obvious to a lot of people, that it was all a giant, horrendous, costly mistake. And now with the passage of time, I'm willing to admit that. And I was certainly complicit in that mistake, along with a lot of other people.
Your book suggests that Trump foreign policy toward a number of countries led by dictators is influenced not just by his own maybe wannabe dictator dreams, but their investments in the Trump Business Organization. Is Saudi Arabia an example of that, as far as you know?
It could well be. I mean, there's certainly the evidence of Donald Trump himself bragging about how much money he's made from Saudis. I mean, the reality is we don't know. I mean, this is part of the Trump assault on ethical norms in Washington, that he has not released his tax returns. We don't really know who he's done business with. We don't know how he's compromised. But we do know that the Trump Organization has done business all over the world. And Donald Trump and his sons have bragged about how much money they've gotten from sources like Russia and Saudi Arabia. And we need to find that out. I mean, this is one of the really positive things that could occur if the Democrats win the House come November, is they could finally start issuing subpoenas. They can get access to his tax returns. We can know what kind of conflict of interest landmines are buried in Trump's financial history.
We can't know is such an important point. Our own Andrea Bernstein, who covers Trump finances, said this on television last night, that we're in the unique, and you can tell us if it's historically unique to your knowledge, position of not being able to tell if a president's foreign policy is being crafted in what he perceives solely as the national interest or also his personal financial interest.
This is a very distressing situation, and what it makes clear is that we desperately need another wave of ethical reforms. We need accountability in government laws of the kind that we passed after Watergate, because now we're seeing that all the cracks that were there, and most previous presidents abided by these norms, but it turns out they didn't actually have to abide by these norms. They didn't have to release their tax returns. Trump has not. And so we need a much tougher set of rules and regulations going forward so that we don't encounter this kind of problem in the future.
Max Boot, Washington Post columnist and Council on Foreign Relations fellow, and now the author of The Corrosion of Conservatism, Why I Left the Right. Thank you so much for appearance number 10. I look forward to appearance number 11.
I look forward to it as well, Brian. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come, including Dave Isay and Bernie Sanders.